Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. I'm too quiet and turn me up a little bit here. Hey, so yeah, welcome to the show. Got a good one lined up for you today. Some things to tell you about and some experts to question. First up on the show today will be Alan Cooperman, who is a professor at UT here in Austin and debunked the case for the war in Libya back in 2011, which I believe was the last time I spoke with him. And now he's got one in Foreign Affairs, where he refrains from crowing told you so, but I believe. But anyway, does a real good job of explaining what a disaster the Libyan invasion was, and directly confronts the obvious, you know, John McCain, Max Boot counterfactual, which is, well, of course, the regime change was holy and just and wonderful. It was just the problem was we didn't invade and occupy the place and determine a new nation-building project of counterinsurgency and government in a box to change their entire society, like at the Center for a New American Security. So, he really does a great job all the way until the last paragraph. But I'm going to let him slide. Anyway, it's Alan Cooperman at Foreign Affairs on Libya. And then the great Alfred McCoy, who is a professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. I think that's what it's called. I've been there. Gave a talk there one time. He unfortunately did not come out to see my talk. But anyway, hi, libertarians of Madison. And anyway, so Alfred McCoy, I've spoken with him numerous times on the show in the past. He's the author of The Politics of Heroin. And then also three good ones on torture. And the one I've read is A Question of Torture. And then there's a newer one since then. And here he is at Tom Dispatch and antiwar.com with The Real American Exceptionalism. And, well, you can just tell by reading him, he's kind of a brilliant genius. I'm going to try my best to stay out of his way and let the man talk, the great Alfred McCoy. And then the great Jordan Smith, formerly of the Austin Chronicle, now at The Intercept. And I've been reading her for years and years and years at the Austin Chronicle, and she is just one of these badass investigative reporters, the kind that I admire, going and actually getting work done instead of being a stenographer for power. And she's really great. And I think she is due the credit. She's greatly responsible for the recent news that Rodney King, sitting on Texas death row, has been Rodney King. Why do I say Rodney Reed, who's sitting on Texas death row, has gotten a stay of execution. He was scheduled to be killed, I believe, on March the 5th. And Jordan has shown that there's plenty of reasonable doubt as to his guilt. And there's new developments. I guess that's pretty much it, is the stay. And so the great Jordan Smith will be on to talk about that. And then also, one more, our friend Grant Smith from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy will be on. You know, I should be better about the cliffhangers and stuff and whatever. Anyway, now I'll tell you. He's suing to force Israel to pay to clean up the mess left over at the NUMEX site in Apollo, Pennsylvania, where the Israelis had... I forgot if they made it or took it over, but anyway, I think they made it. But it was a nuclear site, a nuclear power company, where they were producing weapons-grade uranium and stealing it, taking it out of the country for Israel's nuclear program, nuclear weapons program. And they left a polluted mess. And so Grant is suing them to make them pay for it. And of course, this is part of that same story where the nuclear triggers were smuggled to buy a company that Benjamin Netanyahu was a part of in Israel back then. So, big deal there. Grant F. Smith suing the Israelis for cleaning up their nuclear mess where they polluted the United States of America in order to steal weapons-grade uranium. I really should start doing all my stories about America and Israel and Britain should always be framed first in, oh my God, did you hear what the Russians did? So this little old lady was trying to bring cupcakes to her granddaughters at this school. And these Russian cops came and said she wasn't allowed to be there, manhandled her, maced her, hit her, knocked her on the ground, handcuffed her, and dragged her away. She's covered in bruises, went to the hospital. She's 79 years old. These Russian thug cops, except that, of course, that was in the United States of America. But isn't that a great story about what thugs Russian cops are when it's a story about Russia? Sorry, it's Fresno, California. But, yeah, the Iranians, they came and stole a bunch of weapons-grade uranium from the United States. Nuke them now before it's too late. Ah! Oh, no, that was Israel that did that. Left a bunch of pollution behind after stealing a bunch of weapons-grade uranium. All right, anyway. So that's fun. Hey, last night, so that's everybody, right? Yeah, Cooperman, McCoy, Smith, and other Smith, no relation. Okay, so last night at Liberty.me, Jeff Tucker and I debuted our new show, Eye on the Empire. And we had a good little talk there, and you know, I was not so sure about the part that I brought up about central banking and all the strip malls and whatever. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think it's an important point, but I kind of thought maybe that was the dumbest part of the show. But I got an email saying, no, I like that part. So that's good. And anyway, I really like Jeff Tucker, man. And I'm really looking forward to continuing this series. Right now we're scheduled for doing it once a month, but maybe we can do it every 2 weeks. Or I'm down for whatever. There's so much to cover. And my only regret, well, I have two regrets. The first one is we didn't get to talk about two of his great articles that I was prepared to talk about, wanted to talk about, that he's written recently. One of them about education and the other one about a political allegory in the movie 50 Shades of Grey, which I admit I have not seen. But anyway, it was an interesting article, and so I want to talk about that. And then the other thing is, an hour goes real fast. I've been doing this a long time. I'm not sure how much time. I guess Jeff does a lot of radio and TV type interviews and stuff too. But anyway, I think both of us were a little taken by surprise by how quickly the time went. We ended up going a little bit over time anyway, but just like 5 minutes or something. But the problem was we were going to talk about Ukraine. This is a big issue. For different reasons, for last night's show, but then he didn't ask me about it until about 10 minutes left. And what I really should have done is said, let's wait till next time. We really don't have time. So I tried to cram in as much as I could, but, you know, I don't know. I think if you were coming from the other point of view, the one that he was, you know, trying to represent, which is he's citing libertarians who see the Ukraine crisis, European libertarians who see the Ukraine crisis differently than I do. And, you know, I don't know if, you know, what I had to say was in the time allotted without going over my notes and whatever was good enough to really win. But I think it's pretty clear that expanding the American empire to Hungary might help liberalize Hungary in some way, but doesn't mean that we should be for that in any way. Still is a tremendous cost to us, best case scenario. To make an analogy, I'm not confusing the two countries, I'm just saying hypothetically, you understand? Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, eye on the empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I got so much to cover. I got Palestine news and Afghanistan. But, well, come on, you already know. They're staying in Afghanistan. That's the news from there. Palestine, they're taking it. Yeah. Okay. But, no, what I need to talk about now is Iran. There is so much hype. And I know, I do it to myself because I watch Fox News all day. And I'm just, man, I might as well get a Twitter chip in my brain at this point. I'm so stuck to Twitter. And then I wonder why I get nothing else done. It's completely ridiculous. But there is so much hype and misunderstanding about Iran and their nuclear program and the nuclear deal that is going on right now. And I'm absolutely sympathetic, even to the media people who don't get it, because nuclear technology is a difficult thing. And treaties and safeguards agreements and all these things are all very complicated too. What the hell is an additional protocol to a safeguards agreement under a non-proliferation treaty, right? I just lost, you know, 15 people right there just trying to say that. So it's complicated. So, but who's got an opinion no matter how complicated it is? Right, a bunch of liars and warmongers and Israel firsters. They don't care whether they're right or not. They don't care whether facts make any sense whatsoever. All they know is they got some slogans and they're going to shout them. I'm watching Fox News this morning. Iran must be kept from a nuclear weapon. Obama is making a deal that will allow Iran to have nuclear weapons. All right. So in other words, the unspoken premise of his question is, or of his statement, I mean, is, hey, you stupid idiot who will believe anything scary I shout at you. And who won't dare try to double check me. Obama is negotiating a deal with Iran to help them, I guess, get nuclear bombs. Really? And the blonde lady, you know, lip gloss, never reported a story in her life, but she can anchor okay. Well, she has no reason to be, you know, I mean, she actually did say, now that I think about it. Well, I mean, Obama is saying that this is to keep them from getting a bomb, though. But so she's confused. She's not refuting him or contradicting him. But she, you know, is trying to believe him in spite of the little bit she knows about it. That, well, wait, I thought the whole thing was we're arguing about whether or not this is a good way to keep them from making it. Not, huh? Little bit cross-eyed there, even on Fox News. But so here's everything you need to know about Iran's nuclear program. First of all, the book on it is by the great Gareth Porter, and it's called Manufactured Crisis. It's about how that's exactly what all this is. Nothing. The old Ayatollah, the mean-as-hell one that overthrew the American sock puppet dictator back in 79 as the greatest poster boy for terrorism in the history of the world, the Ayatollah Khomeini, delivered, you know, instructed his government with a fatwa, which means he's not just a dictator, but he's claiming divine authority, basically, or at least the highest rank to interpret what's true about Allah and Muhammad, and they say that weapons of mass destruction are banned. He wouldn't even let them make chemical weapons during when Ronald Reagan was giving them to Saddam Hussein and helping him target Iranian troops with them. He wouldn't even let them do make chemical weapons, although parts of the government did pursue the precursors and whatever. They needed his permission to go ahead, and he wouldn't give it to them. And the same thing for nukes. And every bit of so-called smoke, meaning fire, that there's a nuclear weapons program in Iran is not smoke at all. It's just steam. It's just hot air by a bunch of liars and Israel lobbyists. That's all it is. There's not a bit of it that stands up. What they have is a civilian nuclear program. Iran is a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they have a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency that allows them to safeguard all facilities where nuclear material is being used in any way. And so that's the Isfahan reactor, or not reactor, the Isfahan, I never can pronounce it right, Isfahan facility where they convert the refined uranium ore into hexafluoride gas, and then that goes for the pilot project plants and the rest of them, the industrial-sized ones, where they're actually enriching uranium and all the uranium storage, and then where it all goes when they convert it to fuel plates and use it in their reactors and so forth. So it's all safeguarded. And the IAEA has, quote, continued to verify the non-diversion of declared nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose, end quote, a million times, over and over and over again. All the rest of the IAEA saying, well, we can't disprove 10,000 negatives based off of Israeli-forged laptops that purport to show some stuff that we won't even vouch for, that we won't even claim to believe in the documents, really. All that is not even under the safeguards agreement. All that is UN mandated. They could have hired anybody, not the IAEA. They could have hired any agency they wanted and given them that mandate. They gave it to the IAEA in a way, instead of creating a new commission or something, to conflate. Oh, well, they won't let us into their missile facilities, so therefore they're not being cooperative on their nuclear program. That's just a lie. You see the lie in it? Right, it's a lie. It's an entirely separate mandate and a ridiculous one and far outside of the non-proliferation treaty or anything that they signed up for. And meanwhile, that's what they got. They've got the Natanz facility where they're enriching uranium to a measly 3.6% industrial grade for electricity. They have a heavy water reactor and at Arak, A-R-A-K, and it does produce plutonium, or it will once it's up and running, but it's got to be separated out from all the rest of the pollutants in it, and they don't have a facility for that. And there's no way they could do anything with it in secret. They have to take the lid off of a gigantic building, and they'd have to turn the reactor off and let it cool for a year or most of a year before harvesting the plutonium out of there. In other words, only the Russians can do it. And the Iranians are already making the modifications to the reactor that will make the plutonium waste even more polluted with other byproducts, and therefore impossible, virtually impossible, even if they had a separate facility to separate it into weapons-grade equipment. And then meanwhile, they have no ability to implode a bomb anyway. They would need a massive program to be able to make an implosion bomb out of plutonium. A gun-type uranium nuke is easier, but they could have made one of those all this time if that was what they wanted to make. They wanted to kick the inspectors out. We've been in Democrat years since 2009. So you can't use the, well, George Bush scared them from doing it. They could have made a gun-type nuke, like a Hiroshima bomb, but they haven't. Instead, the IAEA has continued to verify the non-diversion of declared nuclear material, et cetera, et cetera. And all the Obama administration is negotiating now, despite all the hype that you hear, is basically for Iran to adopt an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement, or, you know, something of that same sort that allows for expanded inspections at facilities that don't necessarily include specifically nuclear material, but are somewhat related, etc., like that, and expand the ability of the IAEA to do spot inspections and things like that. And in exchange for lifting the sanctions that we have on them in the name of preventing the accomplishment of a nuclear weapons program that never existed in the first place. We have no right to do to them, which is aggression against the people of that country in the first place. And all to prevent no risk at all. So, there. They're lying to you. So, stop believing them, please. Thank you.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. Get my headphones on here. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. We're live from noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. And our first guest on the show today is Alan Cooperman. He actually is a professor at UT here in Austin, Texas, teaches public affairs. And you might remember we talked to him back in 2011 when he wrote that great article for Boston.com. I don't know if they printed it in the paper, but debunking the pretext for the Libyan war. And now he's got one here 4 years later in Foreign Affairs at foreignaffairs.com, Obama's Libya debacle. How a well-meaning, they dropped the ironic quotes for some reason, I'm not sure. How a well-meaning intervention ended in failure. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me back.
Very happy to have you on the show, and great piece here. I'm sorry Foreign Affairs apparently put up the wall. They let me look at it a couple of times, so I wasn't able to reread the story this morning, but it is a very good one.
I can send you a link that's that goes around the firewall for the paywall for about a month.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, I'll tweet that out and post that okay. In the chat room for people, too, because it really is a great article. I'd quibble with you in the last paragraph, but I won't bother. Let's start at the beginning with how it was that we got into this, and, in fact, maybe a little bit of a rehash of that famous article at Boston.com where you asked, was this a false pretense for war in Libya? How did we even get into this mess back in 2011?
Well, there was an uprising in Libya, started in the east of the country, and way it was portrayed in the media was that this was a peaceful protest, as had occurred in some of the other Arab Spring countries like Tunisia and Egypt, and that rather than allowing this peaceful protest to take place, that the leader of Libya, the dictator Muammar Gaddafi, had sent in his forces to massacre these peaceful protesters by the thousands. And that had started a civil war that the people, just in self-defense, had taken up arms, and they were so popular that they were on the verge of overthrowing Gaddafi, and then he had once again used massive indiscriminate force against this largely civilian protest movement, and was now bearing down on the city of Benghazi, which is the second biggest city in the country, and he was about to commit a genocide on the scale of Rwanda. And there, as a result of that, there were these calls that there needed to be a military intervention to create a no-fly zone so that Gaddafi could no longer use aircraft to slaughter his own people. That was the pretext for the war. Almost nothing of what I just said actually was true, but that was the way it was reported at the time.
Mm. All right, now one thing that I think is important, and I'm just going from memory from back then, but it seemed like all this happened in very slow motion. There was even, you know, I don't know if it was Palin herself or whatever, but there was a little bit of a rehash of the dithering charge from the fall of 2009 over Afghanistan, that when, oh, when will Barack Obama finally decide to do this thing, said all the critics. It took a couple of few weeks, and then it was really obvious, not just to me, but I think in quite a few different places all over the media that the basis, the rhetorical basis, at least, for the no-fly zone, it implied immediately one domino falls down and you have a regime change, because the premise of the no-fly zone is the people of Libya, the people of eastern Libya, will not ever be safe as long as madman Gaddafi is the dictator in power there. And so, therefore, anything short of a regime change is leaving them in jeopardy. What are we going to do? Have a no-fly zone forever? I mean, and it was that obvious. It was surprising to me that the Russians went along with it. They claimed to be disappointed that the Americans stretched the no-fly zone mandate into something more. But, I mean, how could they possibly have been surprised by that? I thought everybody knew that the no-fly zone is just a pretext for, you know, sacking Tripoli. It was, you know, the French made that clear, that that was what they wanted. Am I wrong?
Well, you asked a lot of questions there, Scott. Dithering, From the start of the uprising to the start of the intervention was exactly 1 month. So in retrospect, it was actually pretty quick action. But you're right that at the time it was portrayed as if the U.S. was behind the curve. And that's because the French really got out very, very quickly, and so did the British. Essentially, the French and the British aligned themselves with these rebels within a week of the uprising, and they wanted to support these rebels to overthrow Gaddafi. However, they couldn't do it on their own. The way that NATO is configured, and the fact that the U.S. spends so much more on its military than Europe does, meant that you couldn't do this intervention without U.S. Involvement in the air in terms of providing refueling, reconnaissance, et cetera. So there were these calls from France and the U.K. on the U.S. to come on board so that there could be this intervention. And then there were calls from the press which said we can't allow another Rwanda-type situation. So eventually that combination and a couple of key officials in the Obama administration really pushed the president to go ahead with this. That was Samantha Power and Susan Rice, who are now ambassador to the UN and national security advisor. And they prevailed on Hillary Clinton, and together they prevailed on the president. He eventually decided to go for this. They got the resolution in the UN. And then 2 days later, they started bombing. So that's the first thing, is that there were these claims of dithering, but it was pretty darn fast. If you look historically at how long it took us to get involved in a Bosnia or a Kosovo, or Libya was lightning fast by comparison.
Sure, that's now true. It's not like, you know, on the day that Gaddafi or you know, within a day or two of Gaddafi saying, oh, I'm coming to get the rebel rats and all that they just started bombing, right? Like, they had a big discussion about it for weeks on end.
That's exactly what happened, is that Gaddafi got to the outskirts of Benghazi, and 2 days later we started bombing. It was that fast. It's from the beginning of the uprising till the intervention was 1 month, but from the time when he got to this town where supposedly there was going to be a bloodbath, it was 2 days later we started bombing.
From the time that they first started calling for a no-fly zone and intervention to the time that they actually started bombing was 3 of those 4 weeks, right?
Maybe a couple weeks, a couple, 3 weeks possibly. I mean, the irony, as I said, is that there is zero evidence that Gaddafi was actually using aircraft to attack civilians. In fact, he wasn't attacking civilians. He was attacking rebels, and we know that from the statistics. So, for example, in Tripoli, where 200, that's the capital, where 200 people were killed after they started a violent uprising, started burning government buildings. Of those 200 people, 2 were women. So what that indicates clearly is that the security forces were not targeting randomly or indiscriminately the civilian population. They were targeting the violent uprising. They were targeting the rebels. And the same sort of statistics come from the other city that had a lot of violence, which was a place called Misrata, third biggest city, where 3% of the casualties were women, 97% were men. And so clearly the security forces were targeting the rebels. They were not targeting civilians. Mm-hmm. And these are statistics, by the way, from Human Rights Watch and from the UN. They're not.
We got to take this break, so hold it right there. When we get back, we're going to talk all about Gaddafi's son and possible alternatives to the war the way it played out and where Libya stands now, with Alan Cooperman, professor at UT, author of this new piece in Foreign Affairs, How Obama Failed in Libya. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. and they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson, 1-800-874-9760, or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, talking with Professor Alan Cooperman from UT, and author of this article in Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, Obama's Libya Debacle, from the March-April 2015 issue. And so we're talking about the trumped-up pretext for war from back then. And I wonder, Alan, I kind of assume, although I don't know, but I assume you wrote this article before the Washington Times series hit. Probably takes a little while to get published in Foreign Affairs.
That's correct.
Yeah. What did you think of that? I mean, was that astounding or what? The degree to which the Pentagon apparently tried to stop Hillary Clinton from doing this.
Yeah, I mean, it was not astounding to me because it fit with all my research and the things that I'd published previously. The really interesting new material were details about negotiations that were taking place between parts of the U.S. government and the Libyan government to try and find a peaceful way out of this either before the bombing started or immediately after it started. Mm-hmm. And according to the sources that the Washington Times spoke to, it was the U.S. government which killed those negotiations and said, no talking, we're going to finish this militarily, not diplomatically. And that, again, was consistent with the things that I had found in my research, but it was more detailed and more going right to the source of people who were in the negotiations. So it just shows that the supposed goal of stopping the violence wasn't actually the goal. The goal was, or had evolved to very, very quickly, to regime change, to overthrowing this guy. They would rather have had a violent conflict that killed a lot of people to get rid of this guy rather than a quick diplomatic resolution that would have saved a lot of lives but would have left Gaddafi or his family in power. So, you know, it was sold as a humanitarian intervention, but it actually sacrificed human lives in order to achieve a political objective.
Hmm. And now, this may just be a matter of opinion, or maybe there are solid enough quotes to go on or what have you, but it seems like from the Washington Times reporting, they have a great quote from someone at Human Rights Watch along these lines, and Michael Hastings' report in Rolling Stone touched on this, and it just seemed my impression, even at the time, at the beginning of the war, that really the most important overriding concern was that after Tunisia and especially Egypt and the fall of the Mubarak regime, that D.C. had a real PR problem, that it was even, you know, clear and obvious on CNN for the American people to see that Uncle Sam backs every dictator in the region other than Iran and Syria. Every other one of them works for us. And so Hillary said, we've got to, for public relations purposes, confuse the issue a bit by taking the side of some protesters somewhere, and here's somewhere, and Gaddafi, they'd brought him in from the cold in 2003, but he was still no Mubarak, right? Not a loyal, close friend of America or anything. So he was expendable. So they stabbed him in the back so they could pretend that America's on the side of the little guy after such an embarrassing black eye on TV. With the revolution in Egypt. What do you think of that?
I agree with you, but it wasn't just the U.S. that had a PR problem. Lots of countries had a PR problem. France had been really in bed with a Tunisian regime that had just gotten overthrown. So that's the most likely explanation for why France took the lead on saying, we got to be on the right side of history when it comes to Libya. Same thing with Russia. You mentioned that Russia didn't block the resolution at the UN. And, of course, they have a veto as a permanent member of the Security Council. They could have blocked it. They decided not to block it. And I think for the same reason, they thought, hey, there seems to be some momentum here. We don't want to be backing every losing regime. I think, you know, were they surprised that this turned out to be not just a no-fly zone but a regime change? Probably not. But they felt they had to go along with it because they didn't want to be on the wrong side of history. And as you say, the U.S., the same thing, that it looked like dominoes. First Tunisia, then Egypt. It looked like Libya was going to fall, and the U.S. didn't want to be on the side of of opposing the wave of history, the wave of democratization, which it turns out hasn't turned out to be so rosy after all. But so I think that the reason the U.S. went into this was a combination of things. I think it was partly what you're talking about, which is this wanting to support the Arab Spring, and partially what I was talking about, which is this real fear of a humanitarian disaster.
Are you sure they weren't lying?
It's very important to go back and trace who made decisions, who lobbied within the U.S. government. It was clear that the Pentagon didn't want to do this. That was.
Oh no, I lost you. The Pentagon didn't want to do it. That was.
The Pentagon didn't want to do it. So who was pushing for it? The people who were pushing for it, right? Power. Power here is based on.
I'm sorry, Alan. I'm interrupting here because we're having bandwidth problems and you're cutting a little bit in and out on us. I don't know if maybe you're pacing around. You can walk back toward the window or however that's working. I lost
can you hear me?
At Rice and Power there. Yeah.
Yeah. So the people who were lobbying were Rice and Power and Samantha Power. Her famous book, she won a Pulitzer Prize for saying we should intervene to stop genocide. So was she lobbying because she wanted to promote the Arab Spring? I don't think so. I think she was lobbying because she thought, hey, here's my chance to put my mark on history and show that the U.S. can stop genocide. And unfortunately, it backfired. It took a war that had a very, very low death toll, and by NATO intervening, it multiplied the death toll by 10 times at least. So not only did she not save lives, but she wound up actually costing a lot of lives, getting a lot of innocent people killed. But I do think that's why she lobbied. So why did President Obama decide to go for this? I think it was a combination. Some people were saying we got to do it for supporting the Arab Spring. Other people were saying we got to do it for stopping genocide. Other people were saying we got to do it because our allies, the French and the British, are telling us to. And all of that went into the calculus, and he decided that this was the right thing to do. And unfortunately, it was bad for everybody. It was bad for the Libyans, and it's bad for the Americans and our interests around the world. It got a lot of innocent Libyans killed, and it wound up creating a massive safe haven for terrorists in both Libya and in Mali. And we've got both Al-Qaeda and ISIS in those countries. It's a total disaster.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, we have very little time, but I gotta ask two different things here real quick. Wasn't it apparent very, very early on here that the rebels we were fighting for were not the people of Libya, but really a bunch of Iraq War veterans of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, et cetera? From the very get-go, wasn't that obvious? And then secondly, I guess just to wrap up, tell us as much as you can about Gaddafi's son and the negotiations to try to maybe give power over to him. That's mentioned in the Washington Times piece, but you really talk a lot about how he was no Gaddafi Jr. He was, you know, really had his own mind about how things should be. Oh no, did I lose you again, Alan? Are you there? Oh, there's a problem with the call. Hold on while Skype tries to get the call back. You know, Skype is a give-and-take kind of technology, isn't it? It sounds better than a landline, but then again, sometimes it just completely cuts out for no reason. I hope that's not on my end. Everybody in the chat room, you guys can hear me all right, right? Boy, we're going to be done out of time by the time we get Alan back, I think. Hey, there you are. Can you hear me? Check, check.
Yeah, hello?
Oh, there you are. I can hear you now.
Okay. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
Blame Time Warner.
Yeah, I will blame Time Warner. That's exactly right.
Okay. So, it was clear from the beginning that some of the rebels were radical Islamists who had fought either in Afghanistan or had fought in Iraq against U.S. In Afghanistan, maybe for U.S. interests, and in Iraq, trying to kill Americans, working with Al-Qaeda in Iraq. These were hardcore, and Gaddafi had suppressed them for many years. They were part of this thing called the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and he had suppressed them. But once we provided air cover for them and pushed back Gaddafi's forces, these folks came to the fore. And when it turned out to be tough fighting, the people we thought were our allies, these moderate liberals, they weren't very good fighters. The folks who were good fighters were these people with al-Qaeda experience. And so they very quickly took over the rebellion, and they're still to this day in control of large swaths of Libya. So yes, I think to anybody who was thinking about this, it was pretty obvious. And if you look at why the Pentagon opposed this, the Secretary of Defense at the time, Robert Gates, said, "We don't need to be fighting a third war in a Muslim country." And it was clear what he meant by that, is that we don't need to be creating another reason for al-Qaeda to recruit against us. So that's that part of the story. As for Gaddafi's son, he was very different from his father. He was very different from his brothers. He was Western educated, and he was fond of things in the West, such as liberal economics and such as democracy. And he said, I will not succeed my father unless there's a constitution created in Libya and there are free and fair democratic elections. It's not going to be business as usual. And Gaddafi, for whatever reason, the father loved this son and wanted to pass power to him. He saw that as a future of Libya. He realized that Gaddafi himself realized that the model he had created was not succeeding, and he wanted his son to be the reformer who would modernize Libya. And during these negotiations at the early part of the conflict, the deal that was on the table was that the elder Gaddafi would leave formal power and he would just go off and have some sort of figurehead status like the Queen of England. And power, real power, would go to his son, Saif al-Islam al-Gaddafi. And so would that have been a perfect Jeffersonian democracy? No. Would it be better than the chaos, anarchy, and terrorism of today? It would be much, much better. So we threw away a chance for a soft landing, and we went for a military solution that, as I say, is bad for Libyans and bad for Americans.
All right. Well, I'm sorry, Alan. I've already kept you about a minute and a half over time here into the top of the hour break. But if I could ask you one more thing real quick.
Sure.
Max Boot says that the problem is a lack of follow through here. And that guy Gaddafi, man, he was such a murderer and a rapist and a tyrant and a criminal and needed to be kicked out of power. No question about it. The problem is that, you know, weak old Obama the Democrat did not go in there and do the required nation building, and probably would have taken just a little bit, but he wouldn't even do that. And so that's what caused the problem.
Yeah, well, you know, Max Boot is talking about Gaddafi from the 1980s, and I'm talking about Gaddafi from when we actually did the intervention. And in that period of time, Gaddafi had switched from being our enemy to our ally. He'd given up his nuclear weapons program. He had helped us in the war on terror, providing intelligence and so that we could round up people who were trying to kill Americans. He was our friend, unlike the current folks in charge in Libya who want to do us harm, who killed our ambassador, etc. As for should we have gone in there and broken Libya and then just put more resources to rebuild it better? Well, once you break it, maybe you should repair it. I think there's a credible case that could be made for that. But the smart thing to do would be not to break it in the first place. Both Max Boot and the president have made this argument that the mistake was that after we invaded and overthrew, we bombed and helped overthrow Gaddafi, that we just should have done a really big nation-building intervention, as we have tried to do in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that's exactly the wrong lesson. The right lesson is that you don't go in and gratuitously break countries, especially when they're your friends, especially when they're not committing genocide, and turn them into a haven for terrorists. So for whatever reason, maybe it's politics, that these folks don't want to admit that the intervention in the first place was a big mistake, but it was a huge mistake. And as I argued on NBC the other day, Libya is Barack Obama's Iraq. In other words, exactly what George W. Bush did to Iraq
That's what Barack Obama has done to Libya. He took a stable state and that where no war was necessary, and he did a war of choice that was gratuitous, and he turned a country that was stable into a country where people are being killed and that is serving as a safe haven for terrorists who want to kill Americans. It's a huge disaster, and it shouldn't be downplayed.
All right. Thanks very much for your time, Alan. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, y'all. That's Alan J. Cooperman, Associate Professor of Public Affairs at the University of Texas here in Austin. I'm used to just saying UT is why I tripped on that. Obama's Libya debacle is the article at Foreign Affairs. We'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Okay, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show here on the Liberty Radio Network. Next up is the great Alfred W. McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He writes regularly for TomDispatch.com and is the author of quite a few books, including The Politics of Heroin, A Question of Torture, and most recently, I believe it is, Torture and Impunity, The U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogations. His latest for Tom Dispatch, which is running today at antiwar.com under Tom's archive here, is called The Real American Exceptionalism, From Torture to Drone Assassination, How Washington Gave Itself a Global Get-Out-of-Jail-Free Card. Welcome back to the show, Alfred. How are you, sir?
Good, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Very happy to have you back on the show. Very important article that you've written here, pretty much everything I've ever read of yours in the past. You start out with a thinker, a conservative thinker named Carl Schmitt. Who's Carl Schmitt?
Carl Schmitt was a very influential thinker in Germany in the 1930s. He was the chief judicial officer under the Nazi government, and he influenced his protégés, most importantly Leo Strauss, who trained a number of the Bush neoconservatives at University of Chicago. Strauss's students included, for example, Paul Wolfowitz, who was a key architect of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and he's now an advisor to Jeb Bush on foreign policy. And Carl Schmitt said very famously, "The sovereign is he who decides the exceptions." And that has become, if you will, the sort of philosophical underpinning of the U.S. world order since the end of the Cold War. Really, dating back to the 1950s, with our great victory in World War II, the United States became the world sovereign. And more than any other single power, we breathed into life the idea of international community. We wrote many of the laws. We created many of the institutions, the United Nations, the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank. These are all U.S.-inspired, U.S.-endorsed institutions. And at the same time, we began breaking the rules that we have been writing. Because as world sovereign, we're the power, the sole power, who can decide the exceptions to these important international rules and laws.
And now, so it seems really to go against our very most, well, my very most basic kind of childhood conceptions of America, the way it was explained to me. Ronald Reagan is just a citizen. He's not anything special other than he temporarily is sitting in the job of chief executive of the departments of the government. That's all. But he doesn't have really any more rights or responsibilities than anyone else. And he only has authority under law. And, of course, that's pretty much mythology, but that's what we're trying to live up to here in America, I think, or maybe we were once upon a time. But I can see how, as our foreign policy is the opposite of that, we kind of lose that conception more and more here at home as well.
Well, I mean, it's still true. The President of the United States is the head of government. He or she is governed by the laws of the land, the laws that spring, of course, from our Constitution. Of course, there's one problem. You know, the United States has been building in the aftermath of World War II, and particularly expanding it since 9/11, a vast secret state. You know, this is something that was intelligence, this whole vast covert domain of U.S. governance, particularly abroad, is something that is completely beyond the Constitution. Let me repeat an axiom that I put forward in this article, that there is a fundamental contradiction between state secrecy and the rule of law. And as one grows, the other inevitably shrinks. And in the aftermath of World War II, we created the Central Intelligence Agency. You got to understand that, you know, for the first really 150 years of the American Republic, we didn't have a state security apparatus. When World War I started, when General Pershing led 2 million Americans to fight in France, we had the only army on either side of the battle lines in World War I that didn't have an intelligence service. And this aversion to secrecy and to intelligence is something that's very deeply ingrained in the United States. During World War I, we created an intelligence service, but in the 1920s, Republican conservatives cut it way back on the grounds that this was a threat to U.S. civil liberties and a violation of the Constitution. And indeed, that instinct to cut and curtail secrecy has remained strongly bipartisan. I mean, after World War II, the Democratic president, Harry Truman, killed the Office of Strategic Services. And then, of course, later on, he created the CIA. But nonetheless, he killed it. After the Vietnam War, President Jimmy Carter fired 800 CIA covert operatives to curtail that dimension of CIA activities. And so, you know, since 9/11, this dimension of the U.S. state has grown enormously, and so has the violation of the rule of law, particularly in the international arena.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, I wonder whether the people in D.C., I mean, Paul Wolfowitz, I'm sure, understands. Well, I don't know what he understands, honestly. But I wonder if the irony is completely lost on them, that it's perfectly okay, they say, for America to be the rogue state as long as we're enforcing what we claim is the world law onto everybody else, which that's always the excuse for the war in Libya, the war in Iraq, the war in Kosovo, etc. It's always to enforce the will of the United Nations and protect the poor people from their own governments, et cetera, like that.
Yeah, I think one of the most visible manifestations of this contradiction between our commitment to the rule of law at home and international law abroad and this idea that the U.S. sovereign, particularly in the world arena, has the right to exceptions to that law, came over the torture debate. At the start of the Cold War, back in the 1940s, the U.S. was a very strong advocate for this idea that torture was an abomination. Indeed, one of the strongest principles of international law and human rights law for the last 300 years has been a campaign to abolish torture as a prerogative of state power. And in 1948, the United States had a predominant role in the writing of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which specifically bans torture. A year later, we were the prime mover in the enactment of the Geneva Conventions for Humane Treatment in War, and that has a specific prohibition against torture. Simultaneously and secretly, however, the CIA began developing secret new techniques for psychological torture to be used against the Soviet Union in the Cold War. Right, so right from the outset, there was this inbuilt contradiction. And that campaign for the international rule of law and the ban of torture continued in 1984 in a truly extraordinary act. The United Nations General Assembly, representing 159 member states, voted unanimously to approve the UN Convention Against Torture. And we ratified that convention a decade later in 1994. The Cold War was over. The CIA had given up its torture techniques, it had expunged it from its manuals and all the rest. Yet, even as we signed the UN Convention Against Torture, which contains under Article 3 a ban on extraordinary rendition, a ban on sending somebody from one jurisdiction to another's jurisdiction where they're going to be tortured. And right away, President Clinton, a year after he signed the UN Convention Against Torture, authorized the CIA to engage in extraordinary rendition. We began snatching people in the Balkans and sending them to Egypt where they were subject to horrible torture. CIA Director Tenet later testified that before 9/11, we engaged in at least 70 extraordinary renditions. Every single one of those is banned under Article 3 of the UN Convention Against Torture, which we signed. And since 9/11, the exceptions have gotten thicker and deeper and more common.
All right. And more on those lines when we get back with Alfred McCoy, author of Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogations. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Alfred McCoy, professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And the book I read, I read Politics of Heroin a long time ago, but I read Question of Torture. I haven't read the most recent one. But boy, is that book a nightmare, all this stuff in there. I'll tell you. Okay, so we're talking about the real American exceptionalism. It's running today at antiwar.com under Tom Englehart's name here. And we're talking about how the law doesn't apply to America because America is the law. And so, but that kind of gets down to the heart of this thing about whether Carl Schmitt is really wrong in saying that, hey, the most powerful person, in this case America, with the biggest military and by many measures, still the biggest economy, we get to call the shots. And the world is somewhat lucky that we have a public relations scheme that promotes things like bans on torture in other countries, even when they don't apply to us. But isn't it really the case that world law means nothing without an enforcer? And that, you know, probably enforcement can't be accomplished without breaking all those laws, like, for example, starting wars, which is the first thing all this post-World War II stuff bans, right?
Yeah, but one of the things I think that's really striking about the age we're living in is the nature of warfare is changing. We're moving away from the old model of heavy metal warfare of, aircraft carriers and heavy cruisers and tanks and all the rest. And under President Obama, there has been a systematic shift of U.S. force projection from the conventional arena of, let's say, air, land, and sea to aerospace and cyberspace. And this represents a real challenge for the rule of law, because what's happened really in the past 100 years since the United States has helped build the international rule of law with international courts is that there's been a, if you will, military technology moves in seven-league boots, leaping ahead by great bounds, And the law kind of follows along in smaller footsteps, trying to catch up. And what we've got now is that the U.S. force projection, its warfighting capacity, is moving into two domains that are still unregulated, aerospace and cyberspace. And we're working very hard to keep them unregulated. Now, one of the key facets of the international community that the United States built after World War II, enshrined in the United Nations, is this idea of national sovereignty, that every nation state has inviolable control over the people and the affairs inside its own international boundaries, okay? So the question then is, how high is sovereignty? How high does your sovereignty extend? Does it go up a mile? Does it go up 10 miles? We know under the law of sea that it now goes out 200 miles, but how high is it? And the fact is, there's no rule. There has been a successive failure of international law to define the upward limits of sovereignty. At the Paris Air Convention in 1910, the Hague Convention on the laws of air warfare in 1923, the failure of Protocol 1 of the Geneva Convention in 1977. In other words, there's been a successive failure by the international community to define the rules of air warfare and the height of sovereignty. So we can fly a drone, in theory, over anybody's boundary. We can fly a satellite over anybody's airspace, and there's no restriction. So that's one dimension of U.S. exercise of global power. And indeed, we've used drones to engage in, let's say, just Pakistan, about 3,900 extrajudicial executions with considerable collateral damage.
But wait, so what you're saying is, you're not saying that no state has the right to attempt to fight our drones trespassing, but you're just saying there's no law that makes it an international crime to use air power to kill people, or at least to fly over other people's countries, as long as they can't shoot it down.
Right. I mean, in other words, satellites fly over international boundaries all the time, right?
Sure.
No, and nobody regards that as a violation, but they're only 250 miles up.
So there's no difference between that and a Reaper drone in terms of the law?
In terms of the law, there is no definition whatsoever. In other words, if you ask some lawyer in the Pentagon how high is sovereignty, a puckish lawyer might respond, as high as you can enforce it and no higher. So in other words, we have sovereignty over airspace because we've got air defenses, right? Mm. But that's not actual enshrined in law. That's just the exercise of power. So there's no limit on these drones, okay? Well, that was fine for us as the world power, and we're the only people that have drones. But just this week, President Obama authorized the exports of drones to allies. Of course, the end-use control over that is vague. I mean, once you give people a weapon, they can use it as they fit. The Chinese are starting to manufacture drones, and they're also just about to have the one key technological item that you need to transform a model airplane into a drone. Satellites. You've got to have over-the-horizon communication capability. That only comes from satellites. From 1965 to the present, the United States has had the only global system of telecommunication satellites. Well, in 2020, the Chinese will have finished the launch of 35 satellites. They'll have the world's second, and that means they'll have the world's second capacity for global drone use just like ours.
Wow.
We've got 60 secret bases ringing the Eurasian landmass, stretching all the way from basically Sicily to Guam. And we have the capacity right now basically to strike with a drone almost anywhere in Europe, Asia, and much of Africa with our drones. We're the only power that has that. Mm-hmm. Well, that's about to change.
Well, now, but China aside for the moment, killing people with drones, say in Yemen or in Pakistan, that's still a war crime, right? Or I guess in Pakistan, we have permission from our sock puppet governments there. Is that it?
Yeah, basically they don't object, but there is a UN rapporteur for extrajudicial executions, and that rapporteur has raised serious doubts about the legality of what the United States is doing. We've even, without adversary legal proceeding, that we've killed four American citizens with drone strikes. Now, these are people that have been basically sentenced to death, and all we have is an intelligence report delivered to President Obama, who on Kill Tuesday looks over the file and approves the hits. That's not an adversary legal proceeding. All right, that there's been no counsel. There's been no contestation of the intelligence. Initially, the White House insisted, the Obama White House insisted that everybody killed by a drone was the object of the attack. But now we know that's not true. The Bureau for Investigative Journalism in London, which is carefully monitoring these drone strikes in Pakistan, has established that under President Obama there have been 3,800 deaths. Of those deaths, as many as 900 have been civilians, and as many as 200 have been children. So clearly there's collateral damage. People are dying in these strikes that are not, you know, the guilty parties. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a problem. These are extrajudicial killings, and that is a violation of both U.S. law and international law.
Sure. And then the point being, of course, not that the breaking of the law is the worst part. It's the murder that's the worst part, but what's important is that law can't stop it, really. That's what you're getting at here.
There is no instrument for it. I mean, that's the problem is that the international rule of law, even though there is an international court of justice, and indeed there's now an international criminal court, both of which that sit at The Hague and the Netherlands, ultimately the strongest sanction is a moral sanction. That's why the U.S. military, particularly the judge advocate generals of all the four U.S. military services, were adamantly opposed to the U.S. determination after 9/11 that we had the right to torture, despite the fact that we'd signed the U.N. Convention Against Torture. And this was a violation of the U.S. Code of Military Justice, but more importantly, all of these senior-serving military officers were concerned that once we do it to somebody else's captives, they'll do it to our captives, right? And so there's this realization that the ultimate sanction in the rule of law is a moral sanction, you know, self-enforcement, self-restraint. And, you know, as long as we're the world's absolutely unchallenged, preeminent power, the system can operate. We can operate in this contradiction between having laws and being the world's law enforcer and also being the world's lawbreaker. I mean, that can kind of continue. But once our power begins to wane, and our power is waning a bit, there's no question about it, and we can be challenged, that means that then other people will start breaking the laws. We've, in effect, ended the moral sanction against breaking these laws. And that's troubling. That's deeply troubling.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time on the show again today.
Thank you, Scott.
I sure appreciate it. That's Alfred W. McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And he's written for Tom Dispatch at tomdispatch.com. And this one is running at antiwar.com today. The Real American Exceptionalism. It's under the name Tom Engelhart there. You know how Tom does with his introductory essay and all that. And his latest book is Torture and Impunity: The U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogations. We'll be right back with Jordan Smith in just a sec. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys. Sorry. I'm here. Running late. Sorry. All my fault in a bunch of ways. I kept Alfred Smith over time. Alfred McCoy. Everybody's named Smith on the show today. Freaking me out. Alfred McCoy over time there, so he could wrap up one or two more questions. If you want to check out the whole archive there, please do so. Also, installing for time here, I will note that the FBI is claiming that three people in Brooklyn are trying to support ISIS, so you can bet 1,000% that that's just another FBI entrapment job, which makes, 57? Somebody, Trevor Aronson, call your office, man. There's another FBI entrapment, bogus terrorism case in New York City today. And I could also mention, too, that our friend Grant Smith is going to be on the show from the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy here in just a few minutes, if you will stay tuned for that. And now I think I will take the risk of going ahead and going to our guest on the line. Jordan, are you there?
I am. I'm here.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I'm sorry about the time zone confusion. All of my fault and not yours at all.
Not a problem.
Appreciate you making time for us. So,
absolutely.
Jordan Smith, everybody, for years and years did great investigative journalism for the Austin Chronicle, all of which you can read online, I believe. And then now she's writing for The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald and them at The Intercept. And for years she's covered the case of Rodney Reed, who, let's just say there's pretty obvious reasonable doubt as to whether he's guilty of the murder of a woman named Stacy Stites. And we talked with Jordan just a week or two ago on the show about all of that. But the recent news is that Rodney Reed has been granted a stay of execution. Is that right, Jordan?
That's correct. He has.
And for how long is that?
Well, it's in an indeterminate period of time. It just the court acted on it late Monday, responding to the appeal that we talked about last time, which kind of raises this specter that the state's timeline for Stites' death has been off the whole time and that there's now scientific evidence to prove it. And so they granted the stay, and that just kind of, there's no timeline for them to rule now that that death is not on the table and with a date certain. So it's up to them basically how quickly or not that they proceed.
Right. And then, so was there a comment from the judge or judges or whatever in the decision? Was there anything important there?
No, there was no comment. They just kind of gave a little procedural history, very dry order. But a couple of interesting things, I suppose. One is the breakdown of the court. Six judges, I think, voted in favor. Two did not. And among those that did voted to just keep the execution date as it is the presiding judge of the court, Sharon Keller, who you may know as Sharon Killer Keller, because she is very wedded to finality over truth, I think, maybe the nicest way to put it.
You know what? It's interesting you say that. I was just telling a friend the other day from memory a story about a case here in Texas where the judge actually went so far as to say that finality of the court's decision is the paramount concern rather than justice.
Sure.
For someone who was falsely convicted. Was that her? Is that what I was thinking of?
Well, you may have been. I don't know. I would not be surprised if she'd said that off the top of my head. I can't remember if she did. However, I'm certain that she would. I mean, she's kind of notorious for kind of closing the courthouse door here in 2007, and sort of allowing an execution to go through while there was basically still a question. There was still a case pending at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of the United States had said, hey, we're going to review the legality of using a three-drug cocktail to execute people. And while that case was pending, there was kind of a sort of de facto moratorium going on, and so there was a guy named Michael Richard who was supposed to be executed right after that, right after the court agreed to hear that case, and so his lawyers were scrambling and trying to ask the court here to, you know, sort of block his execution until that issue of how lethal injection is administered could be handled. And Keller basically, I mean, it just all happened very quickly. And so they got the appeal to the court here, you know, like just around 5 o'clock. And she basically, you know, put the word out that the petition should be refused because it was after five and the court closed at five. she was ended up reprimanded for that. But that's about it. You know, it's that's kind of, you know, a little bit of her reputation kind of distilled right there for you.
Great.
And so she would have allowed Reed to be executed when we know that there's serious questions, you know, about his guilt. So that I think that tells you all you need to know, really.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's amazing that it wasn't unanimous. But so now it's I'm sorry, did I hear you right at the beginning there? It's been kicked down to the lower court now to decide on, what, a new trial? Or
no, so they haven't decided yet. The court the Court of Criminal Appeals, which is the one that stayed the execution, they'll basically tell the lawyers what happens next, right? So they'll either look at this appeal and consider it on their own and say, eh, there's nothing here, or, yeah, there's a lot here, and we think he deserves relief. Or they can say, hey, we think there's an issue here that needs to be worked out, and so we're going to kick it back to the trial court to have it like an evidentiary hearing with live witnesses, you know. And it seems like that might be likely, because we have, you know, a lot of forensic pathologists here saying that the state's science at the time of trial was basically bogus, and that, you know, that it was, I guess, junk, essentially. And so I think that they will probably want to hear from witnesses for and against that position, because they don't really have the ability to listen to witnesses. They just have the ability to kind of review the actions, you know, of lower courts, and it's right. The lower courts that can hear those live witnesses. So
yeah, and they care a lot more about what a professional scientist says than what her friends at the grocery store say about what they know of the relationship, et cetera, right?
I mean, I don't know. They haven't said yet. You know, I mean, obviously this is very new. We'll figure out what the court thinks is important with this appeal, and what they might not think is important in some time in the next. I mean, who knows? It could take months. It could take weeks. It's just the court's very unpredictable in that way. Obviously, everybody else has, you know, lots of timelines in order to file and make sure things are accepted. But when it gets to their level, it's really up to whenever they get around to it. And you know, frankly, there's been death cases, you know, where they have waited years to rule. So who knows? I think hopefully there's enough of this case is kind of in the public conscience now that they will be, you know, sort of put on notice that they can't just kind of dismiss this out of hand or sit on it for a really long time.
Right. At least they got some more hurdles to cross before they kill this guy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and it's an amazing story, and I'm sorry we don't have time to go back over it all or anything, but I'll encourage everyone to just type in Rodney Reed and Jordan Smith and go and check out what you find at the Austin Chronicle and also at The Intercept about this case, where it's just 100 ways from absurd, man. Come on. And by the way, congratulations, Jordan, because, of course, I don't know a number percentage or something, but, you know, the fact that there's a stay in his execution here is obviously in great part due to your journalism. So that's very important that you've done that. And I hope others have thanked you, too.
Well, that's awfully nice of you to say. I don't know that it had much to do with me. Good lawyering, good advocacy, you know, people like you that try to help amplify the voices of the people who are concerned about this. I think that's they all tie in together. And I think that's really kind of the important thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, thanks very much for all your work on this subject. It's very important.
Thanks again for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, y'all. That's Jordan Smith, formerly at the Austin Chronicle. Check out her archive there. And now she's at The Intercept at firstlook.org or com or something / The Intercept over there with Greenwald and Scahill and them. And we'll be right back with Grant Smith. No relation, in just a sec. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The first of these great workshops is in Orlando, Saturday, March 7th. It's just $25. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is our friend Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. The Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, IRMEP, IRMEP.org. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Grant?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Very happy to have you here. Very happy to see this headline. Israel should pay for weapons-grade uranium smuggling site cleanup in Pennsylvania, says IRMEP lawsuit. So, in other words, says you, Grant F. Smith. You think so, yeah. Huh? You think Israel should have to pay for the cleanup of a smuggling site? Whatever could you mean by that?
I do think so. As we've dug and dug away at this, and this isn't the first time we've talked about the NUMEC case, but it's become increasingly obvious that this plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania was a smuggling front, just like conventional smuggling fronts before it, 20 years before, and that the American taxpayer should not be plunking down $500 million to pay for the cleanup. So we filed a lawsuit to get all of the remaining documents, the most authoritative documents, about why the Central Intelligence Agency has always insisted there was a nuclear diversion to Israel from this U.S. site, so that that can be used to change the funding equation in the cleanup.
Right. Now, so just how dirty is this place? What needs cleaning up? Don't you just send in some bulldozers and then put that dirt somewhere where Eskimos live or something where nobody can fight back about it?
Well, imagine a giant dump site where this smuggling front, NUMEC, was not only depositing its own waste from government contracts, but also trucking in waste from other plants and dumping it into an area that has a warren of defunct coal mines underneath it with aquifers and groundwater that can drip into the Kiskimi River, which is literally right next to it. And then it's full of things, everything from contaminated trucks to clothing to waste that was produced during the process of converting hexafluoride into pellets for the Navy's nuclear submarines and ships. It's a massive cleanup. The site, though, especially the uranium processing facility that was in the middle of the town of Apollo, Pennsylvania, you know, it never should have been there in the first place. And it's not only about the environment, it's also about the health of the people who grew up next to a uranium processing facility that was so undercapitalized, so suspiciously undercapitalized, that it wound up dumping a lot more waste into the environment than a more modern facility would.
Yeah, so now, was the purpose of this entire operation just to get some weapons-grade uranium out of the country and divert it into Israel's nuclear weapons program, or how was it that the Israelis came to run this place in the first place?
The person who organized all of the funding for this, for Apollo Industries in NUMEC, is a guy by the name of David Lowenthal. He was a smuggler during Israel's War of Independence, and had close ties to Israeli intelligence, when all of a sudden he pops up wanting to finance a nuclear processing facility in the middle of a defunct steel town, with Zalman Shapiro, chapter president of the Zionist Organization of America, and Ivan Novak, future national president of the Zionist Organization of America. They start putting together a plant, which is basically a building with very little else except for glove boxes and various equipment, in order to receive government contracts to process uranium hexafluoride into, again, fuel for the Navy and other projects. They have very little capital involved. Their safety controls are almost nil. And they go into business based on Zalman Shapiro's excellent work on the Nautilus nuclear submarine program, which gave him contacts and the ability to convince the Atomic Energy Commission and the Navy to send him contracts. It was supposed to be kind of a model, but it really was a model in corruption in terms of the safety record, the huge amount of losses that occurred until it was bought out and taken over by another company, and the suspicious characters who were being invited into the plant. All of whom initially had ties to the Israeli nuclear weapons program, such as Avraham Hermoni, and then later Rafael Eitan, Avraham Bender, and a bunch of other guys who showed up just in time of the highest losses at the plant. They would later go on, at least in the case of Rafael Eitan, to be widely known as the guy who handled Jonathan Pollard's espionage against the U.S. So, you know, the assessment that this was an Israeli operation from the beginning was John Haddon's, the CIA station chief in Tel Aviv, who was there when the sampling went on to determine that somehow Israel had gotten hold of highly enriched uranium that bore the signature of the type, the specialized type given the NUMAC. So it's very clear from, if you take all of the pieces together, that this was a smuggling front from the beginning, just like the Sonneborn Institute, MarTech, Materials for Palestine, and a host of predecessor organizations that were set up in the United States to smuggle conventional weapons during Israel's War of Independence.
Man, and so then not only did they set this thing up, but they invited all the neighboring companies to come and dump all their nuclear pollution there just as a thank you very kindly, and then left.
Yeah, that was their business toward the wind down of this little operation. And not only that, they got the Atomic Energy Commission, because it was so badly run, to get another company to buy it out, Atlantic Richfield, in exchange for $30 million a year Hanford contracts that had nothing to do with this plant. It was just, you know, if you read the book Divert about this entire thing, it's just a nexus of corruption which is buried up in continual cover-ups from LBJ to Nixon to Carter, in which there's always a reason for trying to keep it secret from the public and Congress, which frankly thought that a diversion had occurred, and continually moving the ball and trying not to deal with the perpetrators or heaven forbid, hold the Israelis accountable for it.
All right. And now, earlier this month, you published a piece at antiwar.com and at earmep.org about some new reports, a report that you got released through the Freedom of Information Act, I guess, from the DOD on the Israeli hydrogen bomb, which, I hope people know, that's the thermonuclear bomb, the super, as Truman called it. The one that, as Daniel Ellsberg says, the Nagasaki-type implosion plutonium fission bomb is just the percussion cap to set off an H-bomb, the kind of bomb that could kill all of Houston in one shot. And I already knew they had them because it's the best hearsay of all, and that is that Mordecai Vanunu told Daniel Ellsberg that they have 600 nuclear weapons, including H-bombs, and I don't think we had an exact number on the H-bombs. But that's where I heard that from, was from Daniel Ellsberg. So that's pretty damn good hearsay. But here you got the documents where the American Pentagon is saying Israel has the H-bomb.
Right. This was a report that it wasn't just a FOIA. We had to sue them for it because they were so unresponsive and evasive in this. And they really showed, you know, sort of the degree to which the federal agency will stoop to avoid trying to release something. But the document unequivocally states that the Israelis have weapons laboratories every bit as sophisticated as the U.S. Production facilities. They compare them to Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos and Oak Ridge, and the fact that they're also, you know, having this technology base for nuclear weapons design and fabrication and laser enrichment and H-bomb development. So I think, and this may be too hopeful, but I think by releasing this, the government has taken a step away from so-called nuclear ambiguity and no longer has the deniability they had before this report to say, oh, we just don't know if the Israelis have a program. And that can have all sorts of good consequences. But one of the earliest of which, I think, is the fact that Reuters seems to have dropped the pretense in its recent articles of stating that they think Israel has a nuclear weapons program. They're not equivocating anymore.
Right. All right. That's the great Grant F. Smith, author of Divert. Check him out at irmep.org. Thanks, Grant.
Thanks, Scott.